Chapter 3. Divine Intervention, Misogyny, and the Rise of Christianity. The rise of Christianity from an obscure sect to the world's dominant religion is a phenomenon unprecedented in human history. So too is the power and complexity of its misogynistic vision, which derives, essentially, from three sources. From the Jews, the early Christians took the fall of man myth, as well as the notion of sin and a profound sense of shame. Later, from the Greeks, they borrowed aspects of Plato's dualistic philosophy and Aristotle's scientific proofs of women's inherent inferiority. To this potent brew, Christianity itself contributed its central and unique tenet that God has intervened in human history in the person of Jesus Christ to save mankind from death, sin, and suffering, the evil effects of the fall from grace brought about by woman. The Christians had inherited the Jewish attitude to history as a preordained unfolding of God's plan. The chosen church replaced the chosen people, just as centuries later Karl Marx would pass the mantle of historical determinism onto the shoulders of the chosen class. But no other religion before or since has been so audacious as to claim that God was a historical person as real as Julius Caesar or Marilyn Monroe, and that salvation would come only to those who recognized him. It endowed Christian teaching with the power of divine revelation. When backed by an aggressive, crusading, and omnipotent institution, it proved a lethal combination, especially to heretics and women. The bitterest irony in this is that during Christianity's first three centuries, women were a key to its remarkable success, thanks to the fact that it gave them a kind of liberation unheard of in the ancient world. The strain of Jewish misogyny already had a long history by the time it was absorbed into Christian teaching, but it would have remained largely irrelevant to the rest of the world had it not been for the events of the mid-first century AD concerning an obscure prophet named Jesus. What seemed like just another split within the always contentious ranks of Judaism attracted little attention at the time. Had there been headlines, they would have been claimed instead by the bloody fall of Sejanus, the Emperor Tiberius's favourite, and the resulting turmoil within the Roman ruling elite. What took place in Judea would not have been worth even a soundbite. However, thanks to Christianity's extraordinary triumph over the ensuing centuries, a handful of proverbs and practices belonging to a small and politically insignificant nation have achieved almost universal status. The myth of creation, as told in Genesis, is now central to the belief of 2 billion Christians in 260 countries. That is, one-third of the world's population have inherited a myth that blames woman for the ills and sufferings of mankind. Unlike Greek misogyny, the Jewish version remained, as did Jewish religion, at the level of proverb, parable, and practice. Instead of philosophy, the Jews had extensive commentary and interpretation of the sacred texts. But the similarities in both the creation and fall of man myths are clear. As in the Greek myth, in the Jewish tradition, God creates the first man, Adam, as an autonomous being who lives a happy, contented existence in the Garden of Eden. His only communion is with the divine. Eve, like Pandora, is an afterthought. She is created from Adam's rib because God thought he required an help. And, as with her Greek equivalent, Pandora, Eve is disobedient, ignoring God's instruction not to eat the fruit from the tree of knowledge. "The serpent did beguile me, and I did eat," Eve confesses rather nonchalantly. Genesis chapter 3, verse 13. The God of the Old Testament proves every bit as vindictive as Zeus. He tells Eve, "And I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception, and in sorrow shalt thou bring forth children, and thy desire shall be for thy husband, and he shall rule over thee." Genesis chapter 3, verse 16. The message for Adam is clear. "And I shall put enmity between thee and the woman," God tells him in what turns out to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. The moral universe of Judaism differed profoundly from that of the classical world in ways which, through Christianity, would deeply affect the development of misogyny. It was dominated by a sense of sin, a concept unknown to the neighboring Greeks and Romans. Zeus and his fellow divinities held gripes and grudges against individual mortals, but with the exception of the punishment inflicted on mankind for Prometheus's overweening ambition, rarely do they threaten to punish the world because of this or that violation. But Jehovah took offence easily, saw sin everywhere, and throughout much of the Old Testament sits in heaven with his finger, metaphorically, on the nuclear button. And the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast and the creeping thing and the fowls of the air, for it repenteth me that I have made them. Genesis chapter 6, verse 7. He was as good as his word on at least one occasion, flooding the world and drowning the whole human race, save for Noah and his family, intending them to repopulate the world. Along with sin came a sense of shame of the human body, something completely alien to the world of the Greeks and Romans. Shame strikes as the very first consequence of Eve's transgression. And the eyes of them both were opened, and they knew that they were naked. And they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves aprons. Genesis chapter 3, verse 7. Passing from the Jewish tradition into Christianity, shame took a firm grip on human sexuality. To a surprising extent, it has not yet relinquished this hold. It gave misogyny a new and destructive dimension. Linked to shame was the Jewish belief, which the Christians inherited as well, that sex was for procreation, not recreation. Among the Romans, moral reformers, no doubt reflecting on the futility of their own efforts to get Roman men and women to behave themselves, admired the moral strictness of Jewish family life. Adultery was punished severely, with both the adulterer and the adulteress being stoned to death. As we also learn in Deuteronomy, chapter 22, verses 20 to 21, loss of virginity incurred the death penalty for unmarried women. But if this thing be true, and the tokens of virginity be not found for the damsel, then they shall bring out the damsel to the door of her father's house, and the men of her city shall stone her with stones that she die, because she hath wrought folly in Israel to play the whore in her father's house. So shalt thou put evil away from among you. Homosexuality was forbidden, as was any wasteful spilling of man's seed, including sodomy, masturbation, and oral sex. Not a drop could be spared from the business of begetting. Apart from the magnificent poetry of the Song of Solomon, the Old Testament is harsh and bleak in its attitude to human sexuality, and almost always hostile towards women. The God of the Old Testament sits gloomily aloft and alone, a brooder whose emotional range is usually restricted to jealousy and anger. The beauty of the beings he has created does not usually fill him with pride, and never with desire. Unlike the divinities of Mount Olympus, he is devoid of love or even lust. He is a master of the psychology of revenge, forever eager to chastise and punish his chosen people for breaking one of the 613 laws that governed all aspects of their daily life, or ready to smite their enemies and prepare the way for the day of judgment when the righteous Jews will be saved and the rest of humankind cast down into the flames of perdition. The Jews shared with their pagan neighbours the premise that the moral health of the nation depended to a large extent on the virtue of its women. The most bitter outbursts from the Jewish God against women come when they indulge in a fondness for finery. This is deemed an act of rebellion against God. Moreover, the Lord saith, because the daughters of Zion are haughty, and walk with stretched forth necks and wanton eyes, walking and mincing as they go, and making a tinkling with their feet, therefore the Lord will smite with a scab the crown of the head of the daughters of Zion, and the Lord will discover their secret parts. In that day the Lord will take away the bravery of their tinkling ornaments about their feet, and their cauls, and their round tires like the moon, the chains, and the bracelets, and the mufflers, the bonnets, and the ornaments of the legs, and the headbands, and the tablets, and the earrings, the rings and nose jewels, the changeable suits of apparel, and the mantles, and the wimples, and the crisping pins, the glasses, and the fine linens, and the hoods, and the veils. And it shall come to pass, that instead of sweet smell there shall be stink, and instead of a girdle, a rent, and instead of well-set hair, baldness, and instead of stomacher, a girding of sackcloth, and burning instead of beauty. Isaiah chapter 3, verses 16 to 24. The God of the Old Testament was remarkable, if not unique among divinities, in being both grandiose and extraordinarily petty, one minute creating the universe, the next making women's hair fall out. In Ezekiel, God goes even further than threatening to give women a bad hair day. Women accused of idolatry, as well as adultery and harlotry with Assyrians and Egyptians, whom they allow to press and fondle their bosoms, shall drink a cup of horror and desolation. And I will set my jealousy against thee, and they shall deal furiously with thee. They shall take away thy nose and thine ears. And the host shall stone them and dispatch them with their swords. They shall slay their sons and their daughters and burn up their houses. Thus shall I cause lewdness to cease in the land, that all women may be taught not to do after your lewdness. Ezekiel chapter 23, verse 25 and verses 48 to 9. Ecclesiastes sums up the misogyny of the Old Testament succinctly when he states, "From a garment cometh a moth, and from woman wickedness." The misogynists of Greece and Rome were constantly berating women for moral failings, but divine disapproval was a new and powerful addition to the history of misogyny. It lent it cosmic significance. The God of the Old Testament is not, one would think, a good model from which to create a religion of forgiveness and love. Yet it is one of the many paradoxes of history that it was on this stock that the vine of Christianity would first grow. The Jehovah, or God the Father, we encounter in the New Testament has mellowed considerably from the thundering sky god of the old. Indeed, some early Christians, like Marcion, found the contrast so incredible that they advocated ditching the Old Testament's entire corpus altogether. What is most striking about the parables and proverbs attributed to Jesus, as recounted in the Gospels, is the absence of both misogyny and vengefulness. Women were among his first followers. We are told by Matthew, "Many women were there, beholding afar off, which followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering unto him." They had good reason to do so. Matthew also tells us, chapter 9, verses 20 to 22, of a woman which was diseased with an issue of blood, who touched the hem of his garment. Jewish law had strict taboos on menstruating women as unclean, forbidding them contact with the male and entrance into the temple, among others. In contrast, Jesus does not rebuke the bleeding woman, but tells her, "Daughter, be of good comfort. Thy faith hath made thee whole." Chapter 28, verse 55. In the Gospel according to St. John, Jesus' disciples are said to have marvelled that he was talking with a woman. John chapter 4, verse 57. In that, Jesus was unique. None of the great classical teachers stroke philosophers, nor the Jewish prophets who preceded him, such as John the Baptist, gathered women followers about them to any significant extent. When Jesus is invited to dine at the house of Simon, he defends a woman whom the host accuses of being extravagant when she uses an expensive oil to anoint him. And Jesus said, "Let her alone. Why trouble ye her? She hath wrought a good work on me." Mark chapter 14, verse 6. The story is repeated in Matthew and Luke. Luke gives the most detail, including the fact that she is a sinner. When Simon points this out to Jesus, he waves it aside. "Wherefore I say unto thee, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loveth much." Chapter 7, verse 47. Jesus judges women not according to some rigid code, but in terms that acknowledge and understand women's experience. In a society where women risked being stoned to death for loving too much, it was a liberating alternative that accounts for the strong following he had among them, one that Christianity later inherited. Luke, chapter 1, verses 24 to 80, describes woman's experience of conception and the wonder of the baby moving in the womb, the first time in ancient literature that this experience is given any sort of attention. The radical nature of Jesus' morality is made explicit when the woman, taken in adultery in the very act, is dragged before him. The Pharisees ask what should be done, knowing full well that the penalty for such an act is death by stoning. Jesus seems to ignore their questions at first, and disdainfully bends down to write in the sand. So when they continued asking him, he lifted up himself and said unto them, "He that is without sin first cast a stone at her." None who had accused her dared accept his challenge, but turned and melted away, and Jesus resumed his writing. Then he looked up, and finding the woman alone, said, "Neither do I condemn thee. Go, and sin no more." John chapter 8, verses 4 to 11. Jesus' sympathy for the woman is in startling contrast to the attitude prevalent in the Old Testament, which is too often a case of, in Bertrand Russell's words, the infliction of cruelty with a good conscience. Mark notes that at the crucifixion there were many women, chapter 15, verse 40. The male disciples flee from the scene, but the women remain to pray. Significantly, after his resurrection, Jesus appears first to a woman, Mary Magdalene, Mark chapter 16, verse 9. When she reports the event to the apostles, they do not believe her. The resurrection is the central doctrine of Christianity, promising salvation. That it was revealed to a woman, and one who was the first to accept it, gave women in general a powerful basis to play a dramatic role in the new religion. Jesus' whole attitude to women was revolutionary. They became crucial to early Christianity's spread. 3 centuries later, when the church had triumphed, St. Augustine admonished, "O you men, who all fear the burdens imposed by baptism, you are easily beaten by your women. Chaste and devoted to the faith, it is their presence in great numbers that causes the church to grow." Women flocked to the new faith right from the start. In the mid-first century AD, St. Paul, in his epistle to the Romans, mentions 36 believers, 16 of whom are women. Most remarkably, one of the very first people we know of thought to be a Christian was Pomponia Graecina, the wife of Aulus Plautus, the commander of the Roman invasion of Britain in AD 43, when Claudius was emperor, AD 41-54. The historian Tacitus describes her as a distinguished lady who was accused of adhering to a foreign superstition, a phrase usually employed when referring to Christianity. This and other hints suggest that at a very early stage, the new faith found adherents among women of the very highest rank. It penetrated even into the imperial family by the end of the 1st century AD. Dissatisfied middle and upper-class women have frequently been a fertile ground for those seeking converts to new cults and religions, as the experience in the United States has shown, especially from the mid-20th century onwards. Other Eastern religions with a strong appeal to women, including those devoted to the great goddesses Bona Dea and Isis, had spread through the empire. But aspects of Christianity's moral code gave women an advantage unlike any found in the competition. Because Christians held that every member of the faithful carries the spark of the divine in his or her soul, infanticide was forbidden, as was abortion. Since a majority of exposed infants were girls, this meant that gradually the proportion of females who were Christians began to rise. Women's numbers were further augmented in this new faith by its ban on abortion, which, due to the dangers of the operation, killed many women and often rendered those who survived it infertile. In the ancient world, both in Greece and Rome, it was the man who, as head of the household, had the legal power to order a woman to have an abortion. Aristotle advocated it as a form of birth control. Evidence also shows that Christian women married later than their pagan contemporaries, so had better chances of surviving their first pregnancy. Nor were widows compelled to remarry, as was the common practice as enforced by the Lex Julia. Christians were expected to marry for life, and infidelity was regarded as being as much of a sin for a man as for a woman. In this, Christianity levelled the moral playing field for women. Christian women were also less likely to be forced to marry, as Christians valued virginity. Traditionally, in the world of classical antiquity, men had been called on to resist the wiles of women. Now, for the first time, women were being told that they could reject men. Women were being offered a choice whether to marry or not. Since marriage was a perilous state, quite a few exercised that choice and opted for celibacy. It offers interesting parallels and contrasts with what happened in the West during the sexual revolution of the 1960s, when for the first time women could control their own fertility thanks to the contraceptive pill. Though the early Christian revolution was in many ways anti-sexual, it was like the 1960s in one important aspect. It offered women the right to choose whether or not they wanted to reproduce. The phenomenon of women choosing celibacy was undoubtedly one of the factors that attracted them to the new faith and so conspired to increase the ratio of Christian women to men. The lists of those who died during the occasional persecutions against Christians bear this out. In Lyon, Gaul, in AD 177, 24 men and 23 women were martyred. At Scilly, in Italy, 3 years later, it was 7 men and 5 women who died. According to Rodney Stark, the ancient sources and modern historians agree that primary conversion to Christianity was far more prevalent among females than among males. The result was that with a shortage of women in the larger, surrounding pagan culture, pagan men often married Christian women, and a significant number of these men then underwent secondary conversion. In his studies of modern religious movements, Stark has invariably found the same pattern of conversion. Its impact on the rapid growth of Christianity can be seen when the numbers are considered. The best guess is that by AD 40, 7 years after the crucifixion of Jesus, there were approximately 1,000 Christians in an empire with an estimated population of 60 million. Surveying the best available evidence, Stark estimates that the most probable growth rate of the new faith was 40% per decade. By the beginning of the 2nd century, there were over 200,000 Christians, and by AD 300, 6,299,832. Just over a decade later, weight of numbers was one of the factors that led the Emperor Constantine to recognize Christianity, ending the sporadic persecutions that had been launched against those who practiced it. By AD 350, Christians represented over 50% of the empire's population. Evidence gathered by Guttentag and Secord on the relationship between the status of women in any society and the proportion of males to females links high ratios of females to males to higher status for women. Stark believes that in early Christianity, women enjoyed higher status than they did in the pagan world around them. St. Paul's references to women as deaconesses are cited to support this contention. According to St. Paul, deacons were important in the early church, assisting in liturgical functions and administering the church's charitable activities. And it is clear that Paul regarded it as entirely proper for women to be deaconesses. Several later sources also reference the prevalence of women deacons in the early church. The most compelling evidence of all, of course, of the high regard for women in the early church, is St. Paul's statement in his epistle to the Galatians. "For as many of you as have been baptized into Christ have put on Christ. There is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither bond nor free, there is neither male nor female, for ye are all one in Christ Jesus." Chapter 3, verses 27-8. Whatever its other implications, it is the most radical statement of equality, of a kind, between men and women since Plato's championship of women guardians in his ideal state 400 years before. But in fact, St. Paul is merely making explicit the implications of Jesus' attitude towards women. He was to Christianity what Lenin was to Marxism, bent on spreading the new faith and preparing Christians to be ready for the coming of the kingdom of heaven, where men and women would be united in Christ and all worldly distinctions would vanish. But how often did this spiritual equality for women translate into social reality? It is relatively easy to claim that men and women are equal in the eyes of the Lord, but did early Christianity encourage them to see themselves as equals in each other's eyes? St. Paul is cited frequently by both those who argue that it did and those who hold that it did not. Like Plato, he is hailed by some as a misogynist and by others as a feminist. What remains undeniable is that the moral teachings on adultery, the banning of abortion and infanticide, and the easing of pressure on women to marry would have directly raised the status of women by eradicating some of the practices that were prejudicial to them. But it was not equality as understood in a modern liberal democracy. There is a further similarity between St. Paul and Plato. The equality they offered men and women could only come about through the eradication of the sexual differences between them. Plato's female guardians must become honorary men so that their sexuality is obliterated. In the Kingdom of Heaven, according to St. Paul, sexual differences disappear. Both thinkers see the sacrifice of a vital aspect of our human nature as the necessary cost of equality between the sexes. In the meantime, however, certain patriarchal traditions must continue. In 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 3 to 16, the Apostle sets down a series of formulations concerning the relationship between men and women and the Church. He reiterates the biblical tradition of male dominance, for the head of the woman is the man, and restates the creation myth of the primacy of man, for the man is not of the woman, but the woman of the man. Neither was the man created for the woman, but the woman for the man. It is also here that he ordains that women must cover their hair when in church. However, he goes on to recognize our mutual interdependence. Nevertheless, neither is the man without the woman, neither the woman without the man in the Lord. For as the woman is of the man, even so is the man also by the woman, but all things of God. One could parse this, as does the Jewish feminist Pamela Eisenbaum, as a simple recognition that man depends on woman as much as woman depends on man. If one accepts this interpretation, St. Paul here rules out that hoary old misogynist fantasy, beloved of the Greeks and of the Old Testament, the myth of autonomous man. That surely is progress. However, while undermining one of misogyny's pretensions, St. Paul went on to supply it with one of its most powerful weapons, one that would change forever how a whole civilization would think about the body. At first sight, apparently, St. Paul was an unimpressive and unattractive little man, with a big, bold head, crooked legs, dark, thick eyebrows that grew together, and a large nose. Hardly, one would think, a man to foment one of the great upheavals in the human psyche. But the letters of St. Paul represent the beginning of a revolution in human sensibility of seismic proportions. In Romans chapter 7, verses 18 to 25, he writes about his body. "For I know that in me, that is in my flesh, dwelleth no good thing. For to will is present with me, but how to perform that which is good I find not. For I delight in the law of God after the inward man. But I see another law in my members, warring against the law of my mind, and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin which is in my members. Oh, wretched man that I am! Who shall deliver me from this body of death? I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord. So then, with the mind, I myself serve the law of God, but with the flesh, the law of sin." This is a declaration of war on the human body, and when a man declares war on himself, the first casualty is woman. It is a war that is still being fought. Many thinkers in classical antiquity, such as Plato, were dualists, aspiring to greater knowledge of the world by attempting to apprehend what they believed was the perfection of its underlying principles. As a result, they rejected everyday reality, including that of the body and its needs and desires, as woefully inadequate, indeed a hindrance. But they did not reject it as inherently evil, as does St. Paul. His anguished cry of near despair at his rebellious body had not been heard before. Plato may have regarded the body as an unfortunate inconvenience that a philosopher somehow had to bypass on his road to the truth, but to St. Paul, the body represented a rejection of the divine, an insurrection against the supreme truth for which the Son of God had died on the cross. Inevitably, women would carry the cross as the chief instigators of this rebellion of the flesh. In the Epistle to the Corinthians, written to advise Christians who were debating whether or not to become celibate, St. Paul tells them, chapter 7, verses 1 to 9, "It is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband. I say therefore to the unmarried and the widows, it is good for them if they abide as I. But if they cannot contain, let them marry. for it is better to marry than to burn. Thus marriage became a defence against desire. Though St. Paul did not advocate that all Christians remain celibate, realizing that such condition would have been incompatible with his ambitions to broaden the new faith's appeal, his bleak view of human sexuality as a necessary evil provided one justification for the Church's increasingly misogynistic vision. Sanctity was identified more and more with virginity. The rebellious body had to be put down, and like an enemy citadel, it was laid siege to with fasts, deprivations, and other punishment, including, most importantly, abstinence from sex. The Greeks and Romans were taught it was necessary to master passions. But according to the Christian teacher Clement of Alexandria, circa AD 150-215, our ideal is not to experience desire at all. By the end of the 2nd century AD, one of the most powerful and influential figures in the early church, Quintus Septimius Florens Tertullianus, better known as Tertullian, AD 160-220, could write, "Think of how a man feels in himself when he abstains from a woman. He thinks spiritual thoughts. If he prays to the Lord, he is next door to heaven. If he turns to the Scriptures, he is all of him present to them." In theory, at least, it is easier for a man to abstain from having thoughts about having sex with a woman if she dresses modestly. According to Tertullian, salvation, and not the salvation of women only, but of men, consists in the exhibition principally of modesty. Women were already expected to wear veils while attending Christian services. It was Tertullian who had women barred from holding ministries in the church because of their power to distract the pious. In the Christian male's war with his body, an attractively dressed woman was his rebellious member's greatest ally. So Tertullian devotes a whole treatise on female dress to neutralizing this powerful force. In it, he asserts that women originally learned the art of decorating their bodies and wearing makeup from the angels expelled from heaven with whom they coupled. The fallen angels conferred peculiarly upon women that instrumental means of ostentation, the radiance of jewels wherewith necklaces are variegated, and the circlets of gold wherewith the arms are compressed, and the medicaments of orchid with which wools are coloured, and that black powder itself wherewith the eyelids and eyelashes are made prominent. St. Paul had introduced the notion of the body as the temple of the living God. Women's love of ostentation and makeup pollutes that temple, forcing God to forsake it. "For they who rub their skin with medicaments, stain their cheeks with rouge, make their eyes prominent with antimony, sin against him. To them, I suppose, the plastic skill of God is displeasing. In their persons, I suppose, they convict, they censure the artificer of all things. For censure they do when they amend, when they add to his work, taking these their additions, of course, from the adversary artificer. That adversary artificer is the devil. For who would show the way to change the body but he who by wickedness transfigured man's spirit?" The misogynists of Greece and Rome similarly censured women for beautifying themselves. To a Cato or a Juvenal, however, a woman's love of decoration was merely a sign of human vanity, though it was an admittedly powerful distraction for those high-minded men who strove towards the virtues of self-control and discipline. It was also an opportunity to show how foolish women were for aspiring to possess such a transient bauble as beauty. But with Tertullian, we are in a different world, one where the border between the natural and the supernatural has been blurred, where God and Satan now struggle for dominance on the battlefield of the human body, and where sexual desire has been deployed on the side of the forces of darkness as one of their most potent weapons. The divine has intervened on the side of those who strive to suppress human sexuality, which means first and foremost suppressing women's sexuality. "To avoid becoming the devil's ally, women," writes Tertullian, "should go about in humble garb and affect meanness of appearance, walking about as Eve, mourning and repentant, in order that by every garb of penitence she might the more fully expiate that which she derives from Eve, the ignominy, I mean, of the first sin, and the odium attaching to her as the cause of human perdition." To the suggestion of allowing an unveiled girl into church, Tertullian responds with an example of how moralists can enjoy masturbatory fantasies in the guise of condemning them. There she is, patted all over by the roving eyes of total strangers, is tickled by the fingers of those who point her out, and, the darling of us all, she warms to it amid assiduous hugs and kisses. In a passage that has become notorious since Simone de Beauvoir's citation of it in The Second Sex, Tertullian proclaims the link between women and the devil. "The sentence of God on this sex of yours lives in this age. The guilt must of necessity live too. You are the devil's gateway. You are the unsealer of that forbidden tree. You are the first deserter of the divine law. You are she who persuaded him whom the devil was not valiant enough to attack. You destroyed so easily God's image, man. On account of your desert, that is, death, even the Son of God had to die. And do you think about adorning yourself over and above your tunics of skins?" Tertullian thunders at women in the manner of the God of the Old Testament, who once threatened to make their hair fall out. But his tone and his words are altogether more menacing. Not only are women held responsible for the fall of man, but it is they, not the Jews, not the Roman authorities, who are blamed for the suffering and death of Jesus, man's Redeemer. It is through their flesh that the devil comes into the world. Indeed, apparently oblivious to Jesus' own attitudes to women, Clement of Alexandria asserted that Jesus' mission had been specifically to undo the works of women, by which he meant sexual desire, birth, and death. His words echoed those of Ecclesiastes, chapter 3, verse 19, "And marriage followed the woman, and reproduction followed marriage, and death followed reproduction." With Christianity, there was a new concept in the world, the concept of salvation. Increasingly, as their faith struggled to define itself, Christians believed that salvation could only be achieved by rejecting sex. This feeling intensified to unheard-of levels during the 3rd century. It was accompanied by a radical misogyny of a ferocity never before seen. The background to these developments was a crisis that struck about 200 years after the death of Jesus, when Western civilization was almost extinguished. Its impact on the way people thought and felt about themselves and the world was even more unsettling than the impact the Peloponnesian War had on the Athenians of the 5th century BC. A series of wars of succession weakened Rome internally. 20 emperors took power between AD 235 and 284, and uncontrolled inflation threatened the empire with economic collapse. Barbarian hordes burst across the borders and thrust deep inside the empire's hitherto tranquil provinces. For the first time in 700 years, Rome had to be ringed with massive walls. A Roman emperor bowed the knee to a Persian king. Two major epidemics of what is now thought to have been the first outbreaks of smallpox and measles struck the major cities and their rural hinterlands, carrying off between a quarter and a third of the people and deepening an already profound population crisis. Rarely had the world seemed more mutable and transient. And it was during these decades of disaster and despair that Christianity enjoyed the period of its most rapid growth. By the end of it, there were over 6 million members of the faith, making it a force to be reckoned with. Since St. Paul, there always had been a powerful feeling of ambivalence about sexuality within Christianity. But the early Christians experienced the joy of believing that the return of Jesus was imminent when all such problems would be resolved. The mood changed as time passed. Origen, AD 185 to 254, the first real philosopher of the early church, decided not to wait for the kingdom of heaven and resolved the conflict between body and soul by having himself castrated. During the 3rd and 4th centuries, the desire to avoid the temptations of the flesh became radicalized into an outright rejection of the body. Edward Gibbon observed in his Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire that Christians felt a contempt for their present existence, which they believed was a merely passing phase that had to be endured. Some declared a boycott of the womb. A young wife turned Christian rejects her husband when he comes to her bed with these words, There is no place for thee beside me, because my Lord Jesus, with whom I am united, is better than thee. Another young woman signals her rebellion against marriage and reproduction by informing her parents she is refusing to wash. St. Jerome, A.D. 342-420, would later sing the praises of Paula, squalid with dirt, as the ideal of Christian womanhood. According to Brown, to break the spell of the bed was to break the spell of the world. The effect of this and similar sentiments was to make early Christianity, with its hostility to sex, disparagement of the married state, and obsession with virginity, one of the most profoundly anti-family movements ever to come into existence. In the eastern half of the empire, this anti-family sentiment expressed itself most radically in the rise of militant asceticism. It is not surprising that the eastern Mediterranean, which was the original cradle of misogyny, also gave birth to its most profound and disturbing manifestation. John the Baptist had set a biblical precedent by living in the desert, surviving on locusts and wild honey. Jesus himself had spent 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness. During the 3rd and 4th centuries, thousands of monks, known collectively as the Desert Fathers, took refuge from the world in the deserts of Syria and Egypt, living in caves or primitive huts, even on top of pillars, sometimes alone, sometimes in small communities. Running from society was a lot easier than running from the body. It has a habit of coming along with you with its bundle of desires and needs, especially those related to women. "Torture your senses, for without torture there is no martyrdom," advised an old monk to a neophyte. The spell of the bed was transfigured into a nightmare of self-loathing as misogynistic tendencies intensified to psychopathic levels, creating scenes like those from a grade B horror movie. One ascetic monk, driven crazy with lust, dug up the rotting corpse of a woman, dipped his cloak in her putrefying flesh, smelled it, and then buried his face in it. He hoped, undoubtedly with some justification, that this would turn him off women for life. In the West, meanwhile, Christianity was undergoing other profound transformations that would affect the history of misogyny. As a religion and a cultural force, Christianity had become so powerful that the authorities were compelled to recognize it. In A.D. 313, the Emperor Constantine, 306-337, issued the Edict of Milan, proclaiming religious tolerance. In the form of Catholicism, the universal church, dominated by the Bishop of Rome, Christianity began to assume the mantle of the established religion, run by a clerical class determined more than ever to restrict the role of women. A few years earlier, the Church Council of Elvira had passed a series of rulings that imposed strict controls on women, both sexually and socially. Clerics could remain married, but were forbidden to have sex with their wives. Christians were forbidden to have sex with Jews. Of the 81 rulings enacted, 34 were codes applying greater restrictions on marriage and women's behaviour, especially in relation to their role in the church. It is as if the council clerics forbade themselves sex and then took out their anger on women. 7 years after the Edict of Milan, Constantine, as the first Christian emperor, revealed the stern hand of the new, increasingly absolutist morality. He passed a law that meted out the death sentence to any virgin and her suitor for the crime of eloping together. The penalty for any female slave held to have collaborated in the enterprise, and they were always suspected of such collaboration, was death by having molten lead poured down her throat. The young woman's consent to the elopement was ruled irrelevant by reason of the invalidity associated with the flightiness and inconsequentiality of the female sex. We find here echoes of the old misogyny of Solon and Cato, but enforced with a horrifying brutality. The increasing intolerance manifested itself in other ways. During the reign of the pious Catholic Emperor Theodosius I, A.D. 379-395, Christian mobs ran amok, knocking the heads off the statues of Vestal Virgins in the Roman Forum, where the results of their vandalism can be seen to this day, attacking pagan temples, and burning down a synagogue. The revolution against the body brought the Olympic Games to an end in A.D. 393 because the athletes competed naked. As a subject for art, the body disappears from view in the West for about 1,000 years. Another hint of what lay in the future as the Church strengthened its grip on sexual behaviour came in AD 390, when raids were conducted on homosexual brothels, which had thrived in Rome for centuries. Prostitutes found there were publicly burned alive. They had been condemned for playing the woman's role in sexual acts, a crime against the new orthodoxy which ruled that the differences between the sexes were irrevocably ordained by God and thus everlasting. Earlier Christianity had tolerated a more fluid notion of male and female, but fluidity, or flexibility in thought and behaviour, was coming to an end. Catholic orthodoxy began defining all the fixed spheres, social, moral, religious, intellectual, and sexual, in which men and women were destined to be set forever, as fixed as the spheres of the starry heavens above. However, if Christianity's profound dualities between soul and body, man and God, man and woman, the world of the spirit and the world of the senses, were to be given a philosophical dimension, there was intellectual work still to be completed. Early Christianity was as innocent of philosophy as modern American Protestantism. Its evangelism bypassed rational thought in favour of faith-based revelation. Tertullian dismissed with contempt any suggestion that the Greeks, as he called philosophers, could be of any use to Christians. The one important exception was the fourth gospel of St. John, with its pronounced strain of Platonic thought. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Chapter 1, verse 1. The Word is identified with Plato's perfect form, existing in a state of timeless perfection beyond the realm of the senses, the absolute reality that the Christians equated with the one true God. And the Word was made flesh, and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. Chapter 1, verse 14. In this way, John declares that the perfection of the everlasting divine presence entered the stage of history in the person of Jesus. Plato's perfect form had become human, the ideal merged with the real, declaring an end to dualism. So it is one of the profound ironies of Christianity that when it began to systematically absorb Platonism, to become Catholicism, it was as a philosophical justification for the set of dualities on which Christian thinking about the world rested. There are two reasons why Catholicism took so readily to Platonism. Plato's appeal was made on both intellectual and social grounds. His theory of forms fitted in very well with a religion that stressed the importance of the next world and expressed contempt for this one. His theory of society, as recounted in the Republic, appealed directly to a church developing an increasingly elaborate hierarchical structure, with a ruling caste of clerics who, like Plato's guardians, have comprehended the absolute truth and are there to interpret it for the faithful and protect it from heretics. According to Bertrand Russell, Origen was the first to begin the synthesis of Platonic thought and the Jewish scriptures. But it was left to St. Augustine, AD 354-430, the greatest thinker since Plato, to establish the philosophical edifice that intellectually propped up the Christian view of the world, including its misogynistic vision. Born of humble parents in what is now eastern Algeria, Aurelius Augustinius was of a family that typified the pattern already seen with the rise of Christianity. His mother Monica was a Christian, and his father Patrick a pagan who converted before he died. As intellectually and emotionally complex as he was sexually driven, Augustine began living with a concubine from Carthage at age 17. Monica was deeply upset, and devoutly wished her son would become a Catholic and devote himself to higher things, rather the way, later on, Irish mothers would pray ardently for their sons to become priests. First a student, and then a teacher of grammar and literature, Augustine moved to Carthage, then to Rome and Milan. He dallied with Manichaeism for years, finally rejecting it because of the incoherence of its cosmology. It was in Milan in AD 386, under the influence of St. Ambrose's sermons, that Augustine converted to Catholicism. But before he found the Lord, he had found Plato. Augustine is one of the watershed personalities of history. He stands at the great division between the world of classical antiquity, which had endured for about 1,000 years, and that of Christian civilization. He is the first person from antiquity who revealed to us the turmoil of his interior world, as recorded in his remarkable work, Confessions. It is like tuning into a television talk show where the guest is revealing his deepest shame, his greatest love, his worst sin, and his highest goal, one broadcast 1,700 years ago, but still with the immediacy of an Oprah Winfrey interview. At the centre of the turmoil of Augustine's search for God is the struggle between the desire of the flesh and striving of the will, the profound dualism that Augustine will incorporate into the very heart of Catholicism using Plato's philosophical apparatus. His cry of anguish echoes that of St. Paul, but with a power and complexity the apostle could not match. "I came to Carthage, and all around me hissed a cauldron of illicit loves. I therefore polluted the spring water of friendship with the filth of concupiscence. I muddied the clear stream by the hell of lust, and yet, though foul and immoral in my excessive vanity, I used to carry on in the manner of an elegant man about town." His bodily desires have condemned him to be a prisoner. "Fettered by the fleshy's morbid impulse and lethal sweetness, I dragged my chain, but was afraid to be free of it." He was stuck fast in the glue of pleasure. Such is his disgust at the physicality of the human condition that he compares us to pigs. "We roll in the mud of flesh and blood," he proclaims. In a later work, The City of God, he returns to this theme compulsively. Referring to the fall of man, he writes, "From this moment, then, the flesh began to lust against the spirit. With this rebellion we are born, just as we are doomed to die, and because of the first sin, to bear in our members and vitiated nature either the battle with or defeat by the flesh." The hell of lust has been with us ever since. For Augustine, the struggle could only be resolved on a higher plane. He read the works of the Platonists, which had been translated into Latin, and found that in all the Platonic books God and his word keep slipping in. The idea, the pure form, eternal and unchanging, he could equate with God. The Platonic vision of a higher intellectual reality corresponded to a certain extent to Augustine's desperate endeavours to break the fetters of bodily desire. But the intellectual heaven of Plato was too abstract and remote. Most crucially, it did not promise salvation and everlasting life. That is why today there are so many millions of Christians and so few Platonists. And it was to Christianity that Augustine was converted in AD 386. Augustine's relevance to misogyny can be summed up in the sentence from Book 2 of his Confessions. "I had no motive for my wickedness except wickedness itself. It was foul, and I loved it. I loved the self-destruction. I loved my fall, not the object for which I had fallen, but the fall itself. My depraved soul leapt down from your firmament to ruin. I was seeking not to gain anything by shameful means, but shame for its own sake." The idea of fall had been inherited from the Jewish myth of the expulsion of man from the Garden of Eden. To this fall of man, Augustine adds another, even more terrible dimension, the Platonic fall. This is a fall from the pure form, to Christians the timeless perfection of union with God, into the mutable world full of life, lust, suffering, and death. It comes about through conception. From that moment we are in a state of sin, original sin. As Augustine says, quoting the Psalms, we are conceived in iniquity and in sin in our mother's womb. The instrument of this fall from grace is woman, both in the sense that it was Eve's disobedience that led to our expulsion from paradise, and in the Platonic sense. She represents the willfulness of the flesh to reproduce itself. We are thus carried away from God into temporal life in which we, thanks to our bodies, are in a state of rebellion against him. We will this fall upon ourselves, and our rebelliousness expresses itself most directly through sexual desire. Because of original sin, man, that might have been spiritual in body, became carnal in mind. Augustine, like other Christians, believed that the only way to break this cycle of rebellion was to subdue the body. It was his own inability to do so that had delayed for so long his conversion. Vain trifles and the triviality of the empty-headed, my old loves, held me back. They tugged at the garment of my flesh and whispered, "Are you getting rid of us?" And, "From this moment we shall never be with you again, not for ever and ever." And, "From this moment this and that are forbidden to you for ever and ever." In spite of the misogynistic interpretation of his doctrine, which became enshrined in the doctrine of original sin, St. Augustine's attitudes to women were more complex. He did not see women as inherently evil. In the City of God, he stresses that the sex of woman is not a vice, but nature. But the terrible anguish of his struggle with desire, which he records with such power, reveals clearly that it is man's battle with himself that is at the root of misogyny. However, for St. Augustine, ultimately it is our will that is the source of evil. Ego, not libido, is the problem that made us defy God in the first place. As a punishment, God gave us sexual desire, something over which our will has no control. Just as we defied God, so our desires defy us. Sex became the battleground, both as a pleasure and a punishment, in a way unheard of before in Western culture. Woman was bound to suffer because of our nasty habit of blaming that which we desire for making us desire it. In a frightening glimpse of what lay ahead for women in the coming centuries of Christian domination, consider the terrible fate of the last pagan woman philosopher, Hypatia of Alexandria. There are but a few women philosophers from ancient times who are known by name. Hypatia is the most renowned, thanks to Christian fanaticism and intolerance. She was born in Alexandria towards the end of the 4th century, the daughter of the mathematician Theon, who commentators say she excelled in ability and intelligence to far surpass all the philosophers of her own time. She wrote commentaries on the geometry of Apollonius and Diophantus, played music, taught Platonic and Aristotelian philosophy at Athens and Alexandria, where she opened an academy, and published a work on astronomy. Hypatia was something of an ascetic, and though described as beautiful and shapely, remained chaste and virginal. From one source, we learn that when one of her students fell so madly in love with her that he exposed himself to her, in order to cure him of his infatuation, she handed him her undergarments stained with menstrual blood. It is a novel way of discouraging a suitor, and proves that it was not only Christians who were affected by the revolt against the body that characterizes this epoch. But Hypatia's virtues, however Christian-like, did not mollify the local Christians' hostility towards her. Alexandria, one of the greatest cities of antiquity and famous as a seat of learning, nevertheless also had a reputation for sectarian violence, often accompanied by the lynching of political and ideological opponents. One of the earliest instances of rioting against Jews in the ancient world took place there in AD 38. In AD 412, Cyril, a Christian fanatic, became Bishop of Alexandria. Cyril had punished himself for several years as a desert monk, but as was often the case, the tribulations of the flesh served merely to deepen his fanaticism and fire his intolerance. Imagine him as a kind of fundamentalist mullah. Certainly his desert years had done nothing to dampen the fires of ambition. As bishop, he challenged the rule of the imperial prefect Orestes, who ruled Egypt on behalf of Rome. In these, the twilight years of antiquity, the growing power of the church was absorbing that of the civil authority, a precursor of the theocracy of the Middle Ages. Cyril was a heretic hunter and Jew-hater. Around Easter AD 415, he roused a Christian mob to attack the local Jews, sacking their homes and seizing their synagogues to purify them and turn them into churches. He drove this ancient community from the city. When Orestes objected, a Christian mob assaulted him. Christians began muttering that Hypatia had bewitched the imperial prefect and was responsible for the breakdown in understanding between him and the bishop. In a sinister premonition of what was to come, a Christian writer accused her of being devoted at all times to magic, astrolabes, and instruments of music, and she beguiled many people through her satanic wiles. For a woman to be learned and accomplished was not only a novelty, but a sign that she was a witch in league with the devil. Cyril was happy to use Hypatia as a scapegoat for his troubles with the civil powers. After a fiery sermon, one of Cyril's followers, Peter, a perfect believer in all respects in Jesus Christ, according to John, Bishop of Nicaea, led an excited mob to attack her academy. The mob found her seated on a lofty chair, and having made her descend, they dragged her along till they brought her to the great church, named Caesarion. There she was stripped naked. Holding her down, the Christians used oyster shells to skin her alive. Then her quivering limbs were delivered to the flames, in the words of an outraged Gibbon. Bribes blocked all attempts to prosecute the murderers of Hypatia. Cyril's career in the Catholic Church blossomed. He was canonized a saint. Apparently miracles, not murders, are what count on a saint's curriculum vitae. From being martyrs, Christians had quickly become inquisitors. In the coming centuries, the perfume of church incense would all too often mingle with the smell of a woman's burning flesh.